Succession number 21564, reel 16.
You're explaining about the... Colonel Cormac, Reel 16. You're explaining about the routine of work.
Yes, I mean, that's right. And then Friday we stopped at lunchtime, technically, except that after lunch we would perhaps have about half an hour, 45 minutes, when we did... mutual training on vocabulary. We had flashcards up and we did it ourselves, and then there would be a film, a Russian film, to run the week off, and then we would finish about half past three, and then free to go home. So as most of us were living in mess, there were very few who had quarters nearby. I was living in Aldershot. I would commute at weekends. So every evening, from tea till dinner time, and afterwards, if I felt so inclined, I could do an hour, 2 hours private study Monday to Thursday evenings.
What textbooks were you using? Were you using standard academic textbooks, or were you using texts written by the Army Language School itself?
There were quite a mixture. The framework was the language school paperbacks, which they'd compiled themselves from many years' experience, so they produced those two books. And then we backed them up with Russian-English dictionaries produced from Russia, and we got them from bookshops in London. I think in those days Collett's was a well-known bookshop, and they had strong connections with the Soviet Union, and we got textbooks and dictionaries from them. And there were other simple books. Russian children's books were very helpful for learning basic stuff with illustrations, and that's how you start to learn the language, and it was good enough for us. There were Russian, of course, Madame Potapova had a series of books in Russian which we used on grammar and illustrative text and so on. We didn't do much in the shape of linguaphone work, but Potapova had some records that backed up her little books. And then I remember there was a German textbook, Dom and Schenk, more advanced grammar, and there was a mixture of books like that. And we had an allowance to buy those textbooks, which were very useful. I still have them.
Did everyone manage to complete the course, or did you have a dropout rate?
Everyone in our course completed the course, and as I say, with varying degrees of success, but we all passed the course, and it was very enjoyable. I mean, some were better than others. That's the way of life. Perhaps the interesting part was going to Paris, because in the about after nearly a year at Beaconsfield, then we had approximately 6 months in Paris. And then you lived with a Russian, they were white Russians, as we called them in those days, and you lived with a family for that time and spoke Russian in the house all the time. And then there were two or three ladies, and there were ladies around about, in Paris, and we went to them for conversation or grammar or some pronunciation. Some were, again, very particular about pronunciation, which does make quite a lot of difference to communicating. So that was a mixture of living with the family, doing homework in the house, and then going out to study periods with these language teachers. They were not specifically trained, but they had a lot of experience of teaching courses. Sadly, that's all gone now, because the white Russian population, they're all died out. And there are no native Russian speakers like that around. So the Paris part of the course dropped a few years after I left. But that was extremely enjoyable. And we used to meet up with our fellow students. Although we were all scattered about, we would meet at the British Embassy. They had a very nice club there, which we were allowed to join. And we would meet there on Friday evenings for a drink, to exchange notes and so on. And we would also meet at the embassy with the military attaché's office, who gave us our pay in francs, that sort of thing. So we had a certain amount of administration back up there. And then we had to send papers back to Beaconsfield from Paris once a week. There was a pack, and we had to complete that and send it off to Beaconsfield to let them know we were still alive and still beavering away and give us an idea of our progress. And then we went back to Beaconsfield for a month or 6 weeks before the final exams.
It sounds like they were using pretty much mainstream academic methods to
yes.
teach you the language.
Things again changed after that. This was 1962-63 period. And I think perhaps they were moved into what we call language laboratories and other
yes.
techniques. But we were using fairly conventional methods. Mm. And it worked reasonably well, I think. So much depended on, of course, the individual instructor or teacher. Some were better than others, and some inspired you more than others, but that's life anyway.
While you were learning the language, did they also try and teach you about Russian life and culture? Was that part of the package or not?
That came out informally, partly through the films,
yes,
which were all well-known Russian films, and partly the Russian and Eastern European instructors occasionally had a social evening when they introduced us, if we needed introduction, to the mysteries of vodka, caviar, pirozhki, and so on. And yes, the Soviet or the Russian habits and way of life. Part of my own interest was in reading Russian history. And so that gave me a background, and that was a nice relaxation. Mm. But I liked to know something about the country I was involved with. When we were in Paris, we used to go to the Russian Orthodox church in Paris and listen to the singing, which was, although it was Church Slavonic, had a connection, was very nice in its own right. And then you would go across the road to a cafe, which was well supported by the ex-Russian, the Russian expatriate community. It tended to be the ladies who went to church and the husbands who sat drinking vodka or coffee outside and when their wives came out, because the service there were continuous. You went in, you would light a candle if that was your inclination, you would listen to the singing, you would hear the prayers, you would wander around, look at the church, and come out again. There was no 10:30 to 11:30 idea. It went on. And then you picked up in the cafe there, which obviously catered for Russian tastes, some of the ideas of food and drink. So that was a gradual process.
Were you directed towards reading Russian history?
No, that was my own interest.
Yeah.
There were the occasional texts
yes.
that pointed that out, but it was my own interest to do that. Mm. And Russian literature, you could take that as far as you wanted. I had a nice library of classics, Lermontov, Turgenev, Chekhov in the originals, and Russian poetry was very expressive and nice to read. And that you could take as far as you wanted in your own time. Very rewarding.
Do you think any of the texts you were set for translation were selected with improving your knowledge of the Soviet armed forces or Soviet politics?
Very much so. More the armed forces than politics. We had textbooks and dictionaries on military terms, because that was part of your colloquial exam. The vocabulary was heavily orientated towards military affairs. And again, at the interpreter's level, you had to understand Soviet military technology. And that was part and parcel of the idea, because you didn't know until the end of the course exactly what use you were going to make of your language. You might have gone to the embassy in Moscow as an assistant military attaché. You might have gone to Cheltenham. Or, as I did, you finished up in Brixmas.
Where did your fellow students come from? Were they from all arms and from all services?
All arms and services. Mm. Complete range.
Did they have anything in common apart from an interest in the language?
No, I would say not. The interest in the language and possibly the sort of job that might come their way afterwards. We had for the first time in our course, because up till that period it was all officer training.
Yes.
We had several NCOs and warrant officers. They tended to come from the intelligence corps, the military police. There were two ladies, military WREC military police, and they were pretty well destined for the Helmstedt crossing and the Autobahn entrance to Berlin. And that was their more limited role. And that's they knew that. That was all they could get. I think the intelligence corps applications became wider. And some of them would rebadge from intelligence corps back to whatever their original regiment or corps might have been and became touring NCOs in Brixmas. But the majority at my time just did the language for the Helmstedt crossing and the Autobahn to Berlin and that sort of thing. Very practical application.
But were you thinking ahead about what you were likely to do or what you would like to do during this course, or were you leaving it in the lap of the gods?
Well, to a certain extent it was in the lap of the gods, because I didn't really know at that time what basis they would say that you would go and to Cheltenham. I don't think that's something that I would have particularly enjoyed. In fact, it was very much, I think, a round peg in a round hole as far as I was concerned, going to Brixmas. Mm. Although I think I'd have thoroughly enjoyed being on the defense attaché staff in Moscow. That would have been very, very interesting too. But no, Brixmas, as it turned out, was absolutely right down my street. I was thoroughly enjoyed that.
When did you first hear that you would be going to Brixmas?
Well, it was the usual curious thing. I got a posting order to a unit called Brixmas, because they a typing error in the order. And of course, I had no idea what Brixmas was and didn't have much idea what Brixmas was. Mm-hmm. But it was at the end of the course when the results came out. We all got our postings. And two of us went to Brixmas. Most went to Cheltenham. So the NCOs and warrant officers went to the border control crossings. And one or two went to MOD and just did routine int-desk jobs until they could use the language in another way later on. And in fact, one of them turned up in Berlin with one of the intelligence companies later on. So you didn't immediately, not everyone immediately got a course that used the language in application. They may have been tucked away and filed away and then brought out later on. That happened.
So you got posted to Brixmas, and in your written text about Brixmas and its history and so forth, you mentioned a number of functions and so on. That one of the things was visits to the commander-in-chief of the Soviet forces at his general headquarters. Did you ever get involved in doing that?
No. There were two officers, three actually, counting the RAF, because the Brixmas was a mixed army RAF unit. Mm. And they each had officers who were specifically posted in as interpreters. Mm. And they were the officers who accompanied the chief of the mission when he went to Sosnov Winsdorf to see the Russian commanders in chief or his chief of staff, depending on how important the meeting was. Mm. And they were there. We all did touring. But the interpreters were those called upon should the chief need to go. Or down in Potsdam, there was the Soviet External Relations Bureau, SERB,
yes,
who looked after the units, the missions, all three of us, the British, mm-hmm, French, and American missions, although ours was the biggest and the best, I have to say. And so the interpreters would take the chief, would go with the chief down to those, so that they had the best, and they, by their very job, got more practice at the language than we did. The curious thing about Brixmas in those days was that I wouldn't say it was done on amateur lines, but there was no formal training for the work we did. And in fact, I spent about a week in London going around various desks, and they all fed me their particular piece of interest that I must watch out for, and to the exclusion of everything else. And I went round that, and one office gave me a camera and said, "Well, have you taken any pictures?" And I said, "Well, yes, I've taken a few family photographs and holiday photographs." "Well, you see, you better take this out and go, and here's two reels of film. Go and take photographs around, and then we'll come back and have a look and see what you've done." Pretty ad hoc. And then I went from there to Rheindahlen, and again, they were much more involved with Bricksmiths, and indeed a couple of them had been ex-Bricksmiths members, and they were able to give me a better steer as to what we were actually supposed to be doing. Because up till that time, it was all fairly vague.
Did you have any sort of induction or training when you arrived at Bricksmiths itself?
It was basically learn on the job.
So you were dumped into the field?
Absolutely. I mean, there were always two or three people who were coming to the end of the tour who were vastly experienced, and you were attached to them to learn on the job, and they would pass on their knowledge. And the drivers and the... Each tour was a touring officer, a touring NCO, and a driver. And again, the drivers you went and the NCOs you used to first were all experienced, and you learn from them. It's rather like taking over a platoon or a company. You rely very heavily on your platoon sergeant and so on. It was much like that. And you picked it up. You spent a lot of time in the headquarters in the learning recognition, so you knew what you were seeing. Very important. And whenever you had a free moment, you would go and look and learn shapes of vehicles, weapons, tanks, guns, everything, and a few aeroplanes, although that was the RAF job mainly. You had to know what the planes were so you could report. And that was going, and so you spent a lot of time learning that and talking to experienced tour officers, going out on tour, being shown the ropes, and then you would be taken out by the GSO1 and eventually the chief to make sure that you were actually getting ready for touring on your own.
How long did that process take? How long was it before you were considered fit to be allowed out on your own, as it were?
Only a week or two.
A week or two. So you had to learn fast.
You had to learn fast. Mm.
Do you remember what they told you at Rheindahlen about what they wanted you to do and what was of interest?
Well, they stressed the organisation. Equipment is a main thing. Know what you're looking at. And they wanted to know how equipment was being, what equipment was there, and how it was organised, and how it was used, if possible, and also any changes in equipment, any variations. Because all the artillery pieces, tanks, guns, communication equipment, radar was always being modified and improved. And it was of great interest to people to be able to say that such and such a radar site at such and such a spot had a little new knob on it, to generalize, and if possible, to photograph it. That was what was of great interest. The Soviet signals communication box bodied vehicles. There was a team in London, one man and a couple of assistants, who spent their entire time looking at these box-bodied vehicles and the antenna and the array that would come from them, and to deduce what they were used for and any improvements or changes. And so it was no use saying that was a Zill 151 box truck with an antenna. You had to be very specific.
What kind of antenna?
What was it? And then they would be able to deduce what sort of level that was operating at. That was just examples, but it was always, you never passed anyone, say, "I've seen that before." You were, apart from the obvious GAS 69, which was their Jeep sort of vehicle, you had to be very much on the ball and take note. Then you had to check on the formation organizations. They were all dotted around East Germany, and there were various garrisons, which people had built up a picture of, which units were there. That was a tank division, that was a motor rifle division, that was an army front unit. you were constantly being targeted to go and see if they were still there or were there any changes. And then you looked at organizations inside formations. Was that a motor rifle regiment or a tank regiment or a motor rifle battalion or a tank battalion, or was it an administrative unit? Was a pipeline unit for supplying petrol through and that sort of thing? You had to be able to recognize from a few key signatures what the unit was.
How did you do that? Did they have boards outside their garrison locations, as we do, with unit identification written up?
They didn't have anything like that at all.
What about markings on vehicles?
The markings in vehicles were non-existent. They had vehicle numbers, vehicle registration numbers, which were very particular. And they were graded into administrative units, training units, operational units. And again, it was possible to give some indication of the unit by its number and the color of its number plate. But that was, in fact, capable of solution, but it wasn't solved until well after my time. But we could say that such and such a column of vehicles, all with numbers in sequence, all the same color, would go into or come out of such and such a barracks. And one could build up a picture of that was umpteen battalion of umpteen motor rifle regiment, and that they were still there. Or that involved a change. So all these things had to be followed up. So it was equipment, types, variations, new equipment, locations of units, who was where. Were the in barracks and were the out? You had to look at a barracks and be able to judge the barracks was empty or it was full. And if they were out, where were they? Were they in a training area, which was usually in a restricted area, which we couldn't get at, or were they out on exercise? And so on. And you had to be constantly watching for those. And we were targeted by our operations officer in the mission, but he was working to a brief from Rheindalen, and they would send a team up twice a year to go over our briefing, give it a new target list, update their requirements, and that would obviously influence the operations officer and how he would task us to go out and tour various areas. The whole of East Germany was divided into three areas, A, B, and C, with a local area around Berlin, including Potsdam, and the French and American and British missions took it in turns. It would be British in A, Americans in B, French in C, and it would be our turn to do, we would do the local, a certain local area. We each had three local areas, and then we would rotate. So every so often, so that theoretically the Soviets would never know exactly where we were going to be.
Or who was going to be there.
Was it British, French? Because they were very keen to know what we were about. And they had a big organization, part of the Stasi organization, and the teams of cars, either official police or in plain clothes, in various cars, and they were called Narcs, by a nickname by us. And they would try and pick up a tour as it left Potsdam and follow it to see what it was doing. Or they would lie in wait. If it turned out that Area A was in British operations that week or whatever, they would lie in wait in various main roads.
Just waiting for you to come by.
Waiting for us to come by. Mm. And the whole country was filled with people who would delightfully inform about our movements, who would see a mission car, would phone up their own way, exactly as we did in Germany, and say that Brixmas car number 32 or whatever has just passed up Route 5 heading north in the direction of so-and-so. And the local police and the odd civilian, the traffic police, the border police, they had uniform guys for almost everything, would also report that they'd seen you. And they tried to then pick up a picture of your movements. So you were doing what you had to do, and at the same time trying to avoid the attentions of these people and doing what you had to do without them seeing what you were doing, or, if possible, knowing what you were doing. And so there was a certain amount of cat and mouse, and that, of course, gave the job a certain amount of extra excitement.
Did you ever have any occasion to meet any of your Soviet equivalents, the people on their side who you would drive around in our
once
areas?
Yes, once the Socksmiths, they were called, same thing, operated three teams in Germany, one of the American zone, one the French zone, one the British zone. Mm. And we used to go once a year, a team of us went down to Bunda, where the British zone Socksmiths team were based, and we would have a social evening with them.
And what sort of people were they?
Very much like us. They were very, very well trained and very specifically targeted and geared up for this work. They tended, I believe, to do more subversive work and proper espionage than we would really do. And they wanted watching very carefully.
Were they Standard Army personnel or were they KGB? Do you have a?
They would be. Everyone had KG officers in it.
Yes.
The Serb organization in Potsdam, I referred to before, had a KGB member. Mm. And we intended to know who he was. Mm. The others were all trained specifically.
Yes.
They were not, like us, regimental core soldiers, just given the language course and a brief training and thrown into it. They were specifically trained for their work, much more so than we were at that time. But it was quite interesting meeting them, and we got on fine. You had to be very careful not to get too involved in vodka drinking sessions, and et cetera, et cetera. We were always warned about that. They were just something we did and quite interesting. And, of course, there was a British liaison officer at Bunda and a small staff who had been doing the language course. In fact, when I was there, went down to Bunda, he was one of the instructors at Beaconsfield was doing that job, so that was another opening.
Could they speak English, these Russian Socksmith personnel?
Yes, they could speak English, but they didn't, very rarely. The Soviet army people, very, very few of them could speak any English. But one suspected that those at Serb, for example, could speak more English than they would let on. Mm. We also had to cope with the East German army. And we didn't recognize them, and they didn't recognize us. So
they were entirely unofficial, weren't they, from our point of view?
From our point of view. Mm. And they were much more difficult. Both Soviet and East German army could be aggressive and chase you about and so on. But the East Germans were much more difficult because they had that uncertainty of their status. And if they collared us and stopped us, we would refuse to do anything with them, and we had to wait until the Soviet representative, who was the local commandant, because the whole area was divided up into commandanturas. Every town had a commandantura and a commandant, Soviet commandant in charge, and he was the chap that we had to explain ourselves to if we were detained by the Soviet army or the East German army. And he would then interrogate us and invite us to sign an act, AKT, an act confessing to whatever they thought we should be confessing to do.
Were you to sign those acts or not?
We never did.
We never did.
Mm. Anyone who signed an act would be promptly sent home. Mm. If he came back and said, I was collared, I was clobbered and detained, and I signed, they said, sign this, and I signed it, that would be the end of him. He would be on the first plane home that day, no doubt. And any breach of security meant that you would be sent straight home.
Were there any breaches of security or anything of that sort while you were there?
Not specifically when I was there, but the other way, what happened, one rather amusing instance is that some tours used to stay overnight in hotels. Mm. I never did.